Most New Yorkers know someone who's left a rural area for job opportunities and the promise of a more vibrant social life in the big city. Maybe you're one of them. But what happens to the communities these young, talented, and creative people have left behind? Over the past 50 years, small towns have been getting smaller. More than 700 rural counties lost at least 10% of their populations between 1980 and 2000. The result? Aging and working-class communities are in rapid decline across America, a crisis that deserves national attention, according to sociologists Patrick Carr and Maria Kafalas. They spent over a year in rural Iowa to find out why some people choose to leave while others stay, and they've called their book Hollowing Out the Middle, The Rural Brain Drain and What It Means for America. It's published by Beacon. I'm very pleased that it brings Patrick Carr to our show today. Hello.
How you doing? Nice to be here.
You and Maria, your wife, have lived around East Coast urban areas all of your lives. What got you interested in this issue? Were you inspired at all by the sociology classic Middletown, which was also written by a husband and wife team?
We were, and I think part of what brought us to do the project in Iowa was a lot of serendipity. I'm originally from Ireland, so I'm a transplant to America. But in a previous life, earlier on in my life, I traveled a lot, and I befriended some people from Iowa, so I knew people from small-town America. And as it so happened, developed some very close ties with people from the town we ended up doing the research in. So fast forward many years and lots of study later, and we were in New York City at a meeting, and we were being asked to basically develop a research site in non-metro America, sort of in a small town. And Maria and I kind of looked at each other and we said, oh, I think we know exactly the place. So, we were lucky in a sense that we had ties. But the Middletown study is a landmark study. It's a beautiful piece of work. And we'd like to think that in some ways we maybe emulate it and maybe update some of the things.
Well, that was a different America. In fact, before World War II, educated people were more evenly spread across urban and rural areas. And now most of the people who have gone to college wind up concentrated in cities.
They do. There is a concentration of the more educated in larger cities. And I think what we try to show in the book is that it's not that young people have never left small towns. They always have. It's not that educated people haven't left, the middle states, so to speak, to go to the coasts. They have. But what's different now is that brain drain is a little bit more debilitating, because what's left behind is a shrinking pool of opportunities for those who stay and for many who return.
And you quote someone who says that the streets of small towns are increasingly filled with 70-year-olds driving 90-year-olds around.
Yeah, it's a quip, but it has, like any good sort of adage, a fair degree of accuracy in it, in the sense that there is an aging population. The town that we studied, for example, its median age increased by about 10 years over a two-decade period. So that's pretty substantial.
Now, why did you name the town? We know what Middletown was written about. You called your town Ellis.
Yeah, we did. It's for two main reasons. One, it's a convention in sociology to do that. And two, we were bound pretty strictly by the rules of our institutional review board for protecting human subjects, that this was such a small place that we kind of had to rename it, not only rename our subjects, but also to, muddy some of the details, because you really have to protect people's confidentiality.
So tell us a little bit about the Ellis that you can talk about.
Sure.
How many people live there?
A little over 2,000. I think a fairly, in many ways, a very typical small town. That's one of the reasons we chose it, and one of the reasons we wrote about it in such a way that it speaks to a larger truth. It has several churches, no stoplights, a bank.
What do people make their money from?
It is, again, in some ways, the typical sort of Midwestern small town, the sort of agro-industrial economy. So there, there's still a certain dependency on the land, although very few people we spoke with actually farm or derive most of their income from farming. There are a couple of local industries, actually one of which is about to close, which is part of the worrying trend towards hollowing out. And then you have, a smattering of professionals, a smattering of people who work in local service industries, some people who work in agribusiness more generally in the general area.
So, is there a big city nearby? Or I don't think Iowa has a really big city. Is Des Moines? Ames, what else is there?
You have Waterloo would be the nearest big city, and that's not that near. It'd be a couple of hours away. The nearest metro area would probably equidistant between Chicago and Minneapolis. Maybe Minneapolis is slightly closer.
And is that where most of the young people would go, or are they more likely to come to New York or go to Los Angeles?
It's funny. I guess the most of the leavers and you know the people who left would tend to go to the contiguous states. So they would go, yes, Minneapolis, Chicago, Kansas City, St. Louis. But you know, we ended up interviewing people in 15 different states, all of, from New Mexico to Maine, Florida to New York, so on. You know, so.
And you break them up into the leavers, the stayers.
And the returners.
And the returners.
Yeah. So, and you know, the beauty of the study, we didn't set out to really study the changing fates of small towns. We wanted to study young adulthood. That's what we were hired to do in the first place. And, you know, what it's like to come of age in a small town. And what we found was the coming of age in a small town, anywhere, you're faced with two main questions. One, do you stay or do you go? And two, if you go, do you ever come back? And the pathways that a lot of these young people had taken by the time they were in their 20s and 30s sort of were along those fault lines.
Is it something that you might be aware of while they're already in high school? Are they preparing to stay or to go?
In a lot of ways they are. And I think part of, you know, I don't think we discovered this either. You know, I don't think this is something that's a wholly brilliant insight. But part of what happens is that young people are prepared from a very early age to go forth on these pathways, particularly the leavers that we call achievers, and those are kids who are the ones who excel in school, the ones who go on to the university, who become professionals, and who are really most likely not to ever come back.
So they're encouraged by their teachers to leave?
Encouraged, cultivated, mentored, not only by teachers, parents, the community as a whole. And I think, again, small towns have sort of always done this. They've prepared young people who have talent to go and do things elsewhere.
Well, where did the teachers fall in all of this? Are they achievers, stayers, et cetera?
In some ways, most of the teachers that we spoke with would have been returners, people who went away for a while and who came back, you know, to live in small towns because they value the lifestyle there. They want to raise their family there.
Well, I got the impression that the quality of education in Ellis is pretty high, at least for the achievers.
It is. It is. And I think part of the larger issue that we see that, if you like, increases the hollowing out problem or certainly adds to it, is the fact that there is an inequality in investments across young people in these small towns, that the achievers are the ones who get most of the resources early on. And it seems to me to be, you know, a foolish endeavor to pour all of your eggs into the basket that's going to leave and not come back, particularly at a time when the opportunity pool for those who stay and many who return has really fundamentally altered because of the economic changes that have impacted these small towns.
There's nothing for the achievers to do, is there? I mean, there are limited opportunities unless you want to be mayor or you want to run the local factory.
Sure. No, right. There are limited opportunities. And I think that's always been the case and one of the reasons that, you know, achievers have always left. But the larger point is 25 or 30 years ago, it didn't matter that much that they left because for those who stayed and many who returned, there were good jobs. You could raise a family. Your kids could do better than you. And, you know, so that gave a sort of a tremendous foundation to a town.
Several of the young people who stayed in Ellis took jobs while they were in high school and neglected their schoolwork, and their parents seemed to be fine with that.
Because it was fine in their generation to do that, that work was something that would save you. And in actual point of fact, we found that in many of these stayers spoke to us very poignantly about the fact that they really feel that work has betrayed them because they started work at 16, were earning as much as people in their mid-20s, and it's a great feeling when you're 16 to sort of say, you know, I'm pulling a grown person's pay packet. But when you earn the same pay packet with the same, if any, benefits in your mid-20s, you suddenly find that, you know, that you were kind of sold a lie, really, in a lot of ways.
Why do so many young people in Ellis choose to join the military? Do their parents encourage them to enlist?
In some ways, they do. The servicemen and women that we spoke with who are currently or had served in the military, many of them came from military families. But this category, we call them the seekers. These are young people who, to all intents and purposes, want to leave for many of the same reasons that the achievers do, but don't receive the same amount of cultivation or don't have the same amount of academic credentials or skills, say, as those achievers, and want to go and see the world. And the military really is the only other route to do that.
And what opportunities are open to them after they've completed their service? Do they tend to move back to Ellis?
Some do. We spoke with several who do, and I think one of the things we don't talk that much about in the book, but we've, you know, since, you know, doing the various presentations on this topic, I think one of the more poignant things we found was that many of these guys come back and they really aren't prepared for that much. And that, again, there's a tremendous feeling of being let down, that, you know, you're going to join the Army or the Navy, the Air Force, and you're going to get these skills. And when you finish your service, you're going to come back and these skills will be useful to you. And many times they're not.
In the cliche, the star quarterback or the star basketball player stays and has a limited life, whereas the nerd leaves, goes to the big city, blossoms, and becomes an important person.
Yeah, that's, you know, probably the cliche. I you know, one of the questions I was asked, I did a talk out in Iowa, and one of the questions I was asked was, well, you know, is it not a very pejorative thing to say that, you know, to label people achievers and label other people stayers? And I said, well, I don't think it is, because the stayers we spoke with couldn't really ever imagine not living in this small town, and for all of the right reasons, because it was just an unthinkable world that, you know, this is where I was born, this is where I like to live, and they, you know, have this tremendous affection for the place.
Is that what brings the returners back?
In many ways it is.
Well, you said that the military doesn't really deliver on its promise. What would these people have expected to have gotten from the military that they don't get?
Well, let me give you a couple of examples that probably underscore the point. One of the young women we spoke with was a nurse in the Navy and had spent, you know, several years serving, you know, off Iraq and, you know, in Afghanistan and so on, and had a lot of field experience. But she had since come home and she was training, you know, the new batches of naval nurses that were going through. And she said, you know, when I finish my service time, if I wanted to become a nurse, I'm going to have to start from scratch to go back to college, that none of what I've learned or none of the skills that I have are directly transferable. And so there is this tremendous sort of feeling of, well, you know, you told me that, you know, if I get these skills that I'm going to be employable, I'm going to, you know, be able to get a job. And
that's like being a doctor in another country and then coming here and being told you have to go to medical school.
Yeah, right.
My guest is Patrick J. Carr, who with his wife, fellow sociologist Maria J. Kafalis, has written Hollowing Out the Middle, The Rural Brain Drain and What It Means for America. It's published by Beacon. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Patrick J. Carr, Associate Professor of Sociology at Rutgers University, New Brunswick, who with Maria J. Kafalis, who's been at the Brookings Institution, the University of Pennsylvania, and Barnard College before she joined St. Joseph's University, where she's an associate professor of sociology. The two of them went to some town in Iowa, unnamed. They've called it Ellis, and the result is a book called Hollowing Out the Middle, The Rural Brain Drain and What It Means for America. It's published by Beacon. You were outsiders. Were you accepted into the community? These communities get rather small. I've been told by people in some small towns that I've lived here 30 years and they still look upon me as a stranger.
Oh, no, absolutely. There is a very healthy skepticism and, you know, there's a cooling in period or a warming in period on how you really would describe it. We weren't totally outsiders because we'd been there before, so we had some links to the town, and I think that helped us tremendously because we were always able to draw on the fact that we know Doc so-and-so or we knew this person, and it opened a lot of doors. But yeah, there was, you know, a little bit of standoffishness, and I think that's pretty standard for small towns.
Well, a lot of small towns are having their populations replenished by immigrants. Mm. Is that happening in Ellis?
Not yet. One of the things we say in the book, and one of the thing that has been the single most controversial, you know, sort of recommendation from the book, is that, you know, one of the ways to replenish small towns is through immigration. I mean, and, you know, our argument is that, you know, part of what's what people react against is where immigration is done wrong. So, and there are plenty of examples of how that's happened. And, you know, Iowa is abundant in these kinds of examples, Storm Lake, Postville, Marshalltown, and places like that, where, you know, the population has gone from 0% immigrants to 40 or 50% in less than 10 years. These are guys who have been brought in to work in agribusiness. Agribusiness has used undocumented workers to depress wages, you know, and so on. And so the arrival of a non-native population, usually non-English speaking, is associated with the sort of decline in wages and so on. And that's actually true, but not the fault of the immigrant population. And so
And it could work both ways. There's a documentary that will soon be shown, I think, on HBO, about what happened in the town of Manassas, where there was resistance to immigrants coming in to the point where they actually, the town council enacted racial profiling, and much against the sheriff's better judgment. And eventually, many of the immigrants left, and not only immigrants, but anyone who had a darker skin color felt unwelcome in the town. And the town's economy suffered as a result.
Absolutely. You know, Hazleton, Pennsylvania is another example of this where, you know, again, this was a town that was kind of dying on its feet. It had, you know, sort of an immigrant influx. The economy was, if not booming, certainly much more robust than it has been. The Hazleton mayor then enacted a bunch of local ordinances that basically, again, discriminated against the non-native population. And, you know, its economic fortunes have declined since. Mm-hmm.
We got a comment from one of our listeners, Laurie, on the Upper West Side. She says, I am a leaver. Every year I thought I would go back until I turned 36 years old and realized that I had lived as many years away from the farm as on the farm. Now that I'm turning 50 and retirement is on the horizon, I find myself thinking again about going back. Every year I take my four children to visit my parents on the farm so that my children can better understand me. I am always trying to integrate the two experiences in my life, living on a Kansas farm and in New York City. I feel like an immigrant in my own country. Did you hear things like that from some of the people you spoke to?
We did, and there's the leavers. We started, one of the reasons I think we stumbled upon this issue really was at the beginning of the interviews we were doing about, you know, what it's like to be a young adult. We asked these people about where they live, what's great about where you live, and you know, what would you miss if you had to leave, what would make you leave, and so on. So we quickly began to see different patterns. So, for example, the stayers, again, these are nonsensical questions to be asking me, if, you know, this is the place I love, and so on. Whereas the leavers would speak very poignantly about the sort of the stages of leaving. So, for example, the achievers would talk about the first day that they arrived on a college campus and how that was kind of a wrenching experience, and they'd talk about the day that they were graduating when they knew that they were going further afield and probably not going to come back. And there's a real sense of wistfulness about this, that they, you know, they feel themselves gradually getting further and further away, and they feel ambivalent about this because they know this was a great place to grow up and they wouldn't be the person they were had they not been prepared and helped and mentored and so on.
Well, if you go back to the farm, you can be self-sufficient, but the economy in many of these towns has really suffered. Barack Obama did well in places like Iowa during the campaign by promising to renegotiate NAFTA. I don't know whether that won him votes in Iowa. Were you there at the time?
We were back and forth at the time. We weren't there at the time of the caucuses, but we'd gone back and forth and we, you know, kept our conversations going with people at the time. Iowa voters are very educated voters. And you know,
that's because they have so much one-on-one with candidates.
Absolutely. It's wonderful to, you know, to live in a small town in parts of Iowa where you literally can have five or six different presidential candidates show up at your diner. That kind of access is unusual, and I think it leads to sort of a very educated voter. So the ones we know, and I wouldn't want to, you know, extrapolate to the whole population, are very educated about the issues, and I think, you know, that's how they primarily, you know, tend to vote. So I think NAFTA was certainly one of them. I think more generally just the economy. No one at the time, I think, you know, small town America sort of felt the cold wind of the economic sort of depression or recession, whatever you want to call it, long before anywhere else did. And I think if we'd been paying more attention to the travails and the sort of small town economies, then we might have been a little bit more prepared for what was, you know, coming down the pike at us.
You mentioned Iowa's marketing campaigns to convince educated young natives to stay or lure them back from the big cities. How did they sell Iowa?
In several ways. Well, first off, very politely. So,
with a please.
Yes, come back to Iowa, please. You know, so and Iowans are very polite. But they had a bunch of ads, which I found were fascinating ads because they would begin with a tagline. So they'd have different taglines about how wonderful it was in Iowa. Iowa, the sixth safest state in the nation. Iowa, where your commute can be measured in minutes, you know, and so on. And then they would have a picture of returners, people who had come back to the state, and, you know, usually very handsome people and very attractive looking people, and, you know, sometimes with kids in tow. And then we'd have a little bio about these people, about why they had come back. So one guy who had worked in real estate in California, and they described him as, he's an expert on where to live and he chooses Iowa. So, and part of his biography sort of riffs on the sort of real estate idea. So he sort of basically cashed in his 1,100 square feet in Northern California for, you know, several acres and a 4,000 square foot house. And, you know, he's still, you know, coming out in front in terms of money.
And but does he have any job opportunities?
Well, see, this is it. You know, in some...
Do they promise that?
They don't promise that, no. And I think that's part of it. Part of the campaign is to just, again, present the image that this is a place where you can come. So, and you've had, you know, Chet Culver's, the governor, current governor's brother, describing Des Moines as the Santa Monica of the Midwest, that, you know, it gets as much sunshine as Santa Monica does, and, you know, why can't
and
we
the surfing is great.
Well, or non-existent, but, you know, so there are ways you can kind of sell this, but what we found was that the professionals who come back, we call them high flyers, and they're kind of the lifeblood of a lot of towns. They don't come back because of incentives mainly. They come back because of the sort of effective ties, so their family are there or they want to raise their kids there.
And they can go back to the farm and not worry about whether they make a profit or not because they are comfortable as it is. But your book is written with the sense that preserving existing towns is the right thing to do. Well, towns have died throughout the history of the United States. Why is it so important?
That's the great question that we were sort of posed as we were putting this together is, you know, so why does this matter? And, you know, is this not just the boom and bust of the frontier towns? And there is an element of that there has historically always been winners and losers in terms of towns. But there are two things that are different now. One is it's not the rapid, you know, flourishing of a place and then it suddenly dies. So, you know, it's something that has occurred very, very slowly over a period of time. And because it's so widespread, there are so many towns that are tending towards the hollowing out that it's just that much more debilitating.
Well, on the other hand, there are some people are suggesting that we turn parts of the Great Plains into a vast nature preserve or Buffalo Commons, the Frank and Deborah Popper, for example. And so that would be a good use of these abandoned town areas, wouldn't it?
In some ways it would. And I think, you know, I don't think the whole area of the Plains should be turned into a Buffalo Commons. And I don't think, frankly...
Well, somebody has to maintain the Buffalo Commons. Right. Maybe there'd be some jobs.
I think there would. But I think the larger point that Frank and Deborah have been making more recently about that is that, you know, think of this as part of a move towards sustainable agriculture and think of this as part of a way to sort of renew or return the usage of land to what it was when it was better used, I guess.
Would things be different if farmers weren't struggling so much?
I think it might be. I think it might be, yeah. I think, you know, part of, you know, one of the things we say is to rethink how we produce food. And I think if we did, I think it's more labor intensive. There is that, possibility. Michael Pollan has written much more eloquently about it than we have. We should think about that.
Patrick J. Carr and Maria J. Kafalas' book is called Hollowing Out the Middle, The Rural Brain Drain and What It Means for America. And the book is published by Beacon. I want to thank you so much for being with us today. It's been really interesting.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I'm moving to Iowa, I think.
We know where.
On tomorrow's show, guest host Amy Edding speaks with Thomas Frank, author of What's the Matter with Kansas, about the conservative counterculture movement and its leaders like Glenn Beck. And then we'll hear the story of how two adventurous women discover the earliest known copies of the Gospels. Also, the New Yorker's John Calipinto on going undercover in our city with the Michelin Guide. Plus, Word Maven Patricia T. O'Connor takes your questions about grammar and the English language. The Leonard LoPage Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Drew Katchen, Stephanie Bernhardt, and Andrea Moraskin. Jason Isaac was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard LoPate, your host. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.